You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, a look at the power of regret. It's never fun to have regrets, but they can help us learn a thing or two. Find out how today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, Wisconsin is home to thousands of lakes. Many of those have beaches, boat docks, and or cabins nearby, but some are still undeveloped, or as our next guest calls them, wild. He spent years looking through maps and satellite photos to create a definition for what makes a lake truly wild. Then he set out with his canoe and visited nearly all of them. Along the way, he took note of the animals and plants he found and dove into the natural history of these bodies of water. Have you explored some of the state's undeveloped lakes? Where are some of your favorite natural areas in Wisconsin to get out on the water? What does the experience do for you? Let us know your story. Email centraltime@wpr.org or tweet us at centraltimewpr. John Bates is a naturalist and author from Manitowish. His latest book is Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, A Guide to the Last Undeveloped Natural Lakes. He recently talked to WPR host Lee Rayburn.
So, John, let's start with a simple question. What compelled you to write this book?
Several things. One was my own personal sense of adventure. I love going to wild places that few people have ever been to or go to now. I find a lot of joy in being in peaceful, quiet places. So that sense of adventure of just traveling around the state was enticing. And I really believe in the old statement of putting yourself in the way of grace. And that is really what happened in this 4 years of messing around all around northern Wisconsin. Put myself in the way of grace a lot in the sense of coming to extraordinarily beautiful, peaceful places and trying to briefly be a part of those places. So there was that from a personal standpoint. And then from a writing standpoint, I wanted to do this because I really believe that the way we protect the natural world is through our love of places. We only protect what we love. We won't sit in front of bulldozers or write letters to Congress people or act in a way that can create change unless we really are passionate about things. So my hope is that getting people to some of these wild places will enhance and deepen their love of these places such that they will work to conserve them and potentially to try to entice the DNR to and the feds to purchase more wild lakes. So because we really don't have that many. So
Well, forgive me for thinking this, John, but your love of our wild lakes in Wisconsin comes through in your book. And I have to wonder if there is an unintended consequence that you could have these wild lakes may not be as wild as they used to be once they catch on.
Well, that's a legitimate concern. We are very capable of loving places to death, and we've seen that happen in many other places. I would counter that, the opposite side of the coin being that my hope being the people will fall more deeply in love with the places by having visited them and will then work to conserve them. So maybe there's an inherent risk that some places may get more use than they have. I'm hoping that that use translates into better conservation, more political action, deeper love.
And one of the things you document in Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, John Bates, is, you know, how many people you see out there, how many tourists come out there, or how much portaging you have to do to get there in the first place.
Right. So a lot of these lakes, not too many people are going to be that crazy enough to portage into, to be honest. I don't, and in fact, there were 10 lakes out of all that we went to, which was somewhere in a range of 138 lakes. There were 10 lakes we never even got to because we weren't willing to suffer enough to get to them. You had to cross a half mile of bog or the road, the old road in was completely grown over and it would have been a bushwhack of a quarter mile or more. So we left 10 lakes that I describe in there and say, we never got there. Good luck.
You sure can. John Bates is a Wisconsin naturalist and author. He wrote the new book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, here on the Ideas Network. He's our guest. And let's take a step back for a second here, John, and because this debate comes up when we hear Minnesota and Wisconsin fighting over who has the most lakes, and this would go into John Bates' definition of a lake. How do you see a lake?
Yeah, so Wisconsin is said to have over 15,000 lakes. You need to temper that with the fact that over 6,000 of those lakes aren't even named. They're so small. My understanding is that those 15,000 the number comes from lakes 2.2 acres or larger. So those are, what's the difference between a pond and a lake? Who knows? Minnesota defines lakes as anything larger than 10 acres. So one way or another, Minnesota wins the battle easily of having far more lakes than we do based on defining the lake anyway as 10 acres or more, or even larger at 25 acres or more.
Well, in your experience, do you think that definition is fair? Because it sounds like there were a number of lakes that you traversed in your book that were smaller than 10 acres.
Well, there weren't actually.
Really?
All the lakes that I have in the book are 30 acres or larger. That was an arbitrary definition that I worked with, because to go to all of the smaller, really tiny pothole lakes would never have happened. I would have died. I'm 70 years old now. I don't think I would have made it. You had to draw a line somewhere. I wanted to have lakes included that were large enough that if you put a kayak or canoe on, that you would have a paddle of at least 15, 20 minutes to go around the periphery of the lake. You know, a little 3 acre, 4 acre lake, there's not a whole lot of water. And so it was just an arbitrary definition that I used.
We have John Bates' definition of a lake. What do you consider a wild lake? Because there are some where you have tourists, there are some where you have fishermen, there are some where you have hunters. What's a wild lake to you?
Yeah. Well, again, an arbitrary definition on my part. So I used a number of criteria. One, the most important to me, was totally surrounded by public lands. So that all of these lakes, you will not see a single private home on. However, you may see a state or federal campground on it. So you might see a camper or something along a shoreline on some of these. You may see a dock into the water at a boat landing. And on a few of the lakes, in fact, there are either electric motors allowed, or on two or three of the lakes, motorboats are permitted. Nonetheless, they are completely undeveloped, publicly owned lakes, and thus are wild by my definition of non-privatized.
John Bates, our guest, naturalist and author of the new book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes. And John, give us some idea here of how our human ecology and modern technology has affected Wisconsin's lakes and their environs.
The very simple and obvious statement is that on a developed lake, you have less canopy cover along the shoreline, less shrub cover along the shoreline, and less understory cover, because people have spent a small fortune, the family jewels, to purchase a shoreline property, and they want to have a viewscape of that lake. And in doing so, in altering the shoreline vegetation, they alter the bird population, they alter the frog population along the shoreline by taking out woody debris along the shoreline, so they have more space for swimming and boating. They're altering the fish populations and aquatic insect populations. So there are consequences to our love of water and our development of water. So and there's consequences to the use of motorboats on water and stirring up sediments in shallow areas and wave erosions along shorelines. So these things are easily noted along developed lakes. And one of the differences, of course, in a wild lake is that shoreline is still wild. And that was one of the beautiful things that I really enjoyed. A number of lakes of, going along these shorelines and seeing, for instance, trees that have fallen into the water, and they've been there so long, they've been colonized by mosses, and then the mosses have been colonized by bog plants. And you have this kind of a mini bog community.
Yeah, one of the places you detail this, John, is in Dry Lake in Vilas County, and they're these bryozoans. Is that what they're called?
Yeah, that's exactly what they're called. Yeah, they're moss animals, and they look like a giant brain, basically. Something from outer space. I've had many people over the years call me up and say, "What in God's name is this thing I just found in our
found
lake?"
A brain.
Yeah, it's a big blob. It looks like a gelatinous mass, and it's kind of hard. But they're really odd, bizarre creatures. They're made up of this colony of things called zoids, you got to look at them under a microscope, and they have these little cilia kind of hair-like tentacles that they extend out in the water, and they filter feed out of this blob. They're just bizarre and unique and really specific to cleaner water. So if you do have them, that speaks well for the quality of your water.
We're listening to a talk between WPR host Lee Rayburn and naturalist John Bates. His latest book is called Wisconsin's Wild Lakes. He's visited almost all of them in the state and is sharing what he found. If these types of areas are important to you, let us know. Have you explored any undeveloped lakes here in the state? What's the experience like for you of being alone on the water? Do you worry about these types of lakes being preserved for the future? You could email centraltime@wpr.org or tweet us at @centraltimewpr. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're listening back to a conversation with John Bates. He's a naturalist and author for Manitouish. He and his wife explored almost all the state's untouched bodies of water and put the experience in his latest book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes. Here's the rest of his talk with WPR host Lee Rayburn.
One of the other aspects that you mention in your book, John Bates, which is Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, is the decline in our loon population and going back to our encroachment on natural habitats and where we meet natural wildlife. You have these moments in your book. It's just you and the canoe and the sound of the loon. And you mentioned grace at this when we began the conversation, and that's what it sounds like in my head. But what can be done with our wild lakes, with what we have left of the natural habitat in Wisconsin, to restore the population of loons in our state?
A fellow named Dr. Walter Piper in Oneida County has been following upwards of 200 lakes in Oneida County for, 30 years now. And what he's finding is a decline, not in the adult population, but in the juvenile population that's returning, and a lack of a successful reproduction in chicks, a less robust reproduction. Anyway, he's unsure what the causes are. So caution is always the principle one needs to approach these things with. We need to manage all the lakes that we have that have loons on them as carefully as we can. And for the most part, I think we are. Got to limit motorboat use anywhere near a loon nest. Got to manage water levels if there's a dam on a lake or a river that's increasing water during the spring can flood out a nest. There's a host of things that we can do, but the problem with loons is they're a migratory bird, and they're going down to the Gulf of Mexico for 3 years before they return. And there's a lot that's going on down there too, and in places in between. So as with all birds that are migratorial, the issue of conservation becomes muddy. We can't just protect everything here in Wisconsin. We have to protect everything between here and wherever they end up in a wintering ground.
You also, in your book, repeatedly refer to the water levels in the state of Wisconsin's lakes and how they run on about a 13-year cycle, but in the last 4 years, those water levels have been pretty high, and you allude to what that can do to a loon nest. What are some of the other effects that you saw as you were paddling around with the high water levels?
Yeah, boy, I found, particularly on seepage lakes, these lakes that don't have a lot of don't have any inflow or outflow of water that are particularly receive their water from precipitation, because we've had so much precipitation in the last decade. They're like 3 feet higher than the ordinary water level, so the shorelines were drowned. Lots of shrubs and trees, I mean, white birches, white pines around the shoreline, they're standing in a foot or two of water. It's pretty crazy actually looking. So there's a lot of dying happening along the shoreline of these plants. And a lot of aquatic plants that are ordinarily just off the shoreline in a foot of water are now in 4 feet of water, and they're not necessarily adapted to being in deeper water. So you're seeing a bit of a change in composition of plants. But this year, this summer, precipitation was way down, so a number of the lakes came down from where they were. I was talking to a fellow actually last night about a lake, and he said it was 50 inches above normal high water mark, but it had come down 12 inches this year. Well, that's great, but it's still 38 inches above where it's supposed to be. That's a lot of water up onto the shoreline.
John Bates is our guest here on the Ideas Network, a Wisconsin naturalist and the author. He wrote the new book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes. And John, getting a little bit of perspective here from your, in your opinion, how were these lakes, how have these lakes in Wisconsin been able to stay wild?
Well, a place is a space with a story, right? So there's a story with every one of these lakes of why they got saved. The problem with that I found was I couldn't find the stories. Those are stories to be teased down. And I'm hoping as part of this book that I'll get lots of emails and phone calls from people saying, you know what, I got the story on this lake and I'd love to tell you. And then I can hopefully do future editions and say, okay, here, let's fill out this story. Because this, I'd love to just to know why every lake has a specific name. I found a few, but somebody gave a name to this place. Why is this one lake called Grandma Lake? Well, who is Grandma?
Yes.
Why is this one called Jenny Lake? Well, who the hell was Jenny? So that kind of stuff. And then I wanted as well to try to find the original Ojibwa names.
Oh.
Because I thought that would be fascinating, because usually that would describe in some manner what the lake was known to them for.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found a few, but by and large, the wild lakes that are left are small lakes that weren't, they may have been named, but those names have been lost. The names that I did find are attached to much larger, are more beautiful lakes that are, of course, were the first developed. So we have quite a few Ojibwa names known, but again, for developed lakes. So I wasn't able to give the many lakes at all their original Ojibwa names for the wild lakes I described in the book.
But one of the central themes to these wild lakes, John, seems to be the public lands are available for all of us to access these waters.
Right.
And the fact that they're to some degree protected for natural habitat and wild animals.
Yeah, you know, we used to have back in the late 1990s and into the early 2000s a program to actually purchase more of these public properties, or they would be private properties at the time, but then bring them into public ownership. It was a Wild Lakes program. And one of the things I advocate for in the book is a reinstatement of that particular program. It's expensive to buy shoreland, but what I found were quite a number of lakes that had only one owner, and it may in some cases be an entire lake owned by one person, but it may also have been a lake with just one small inholding of 10% of the shoreline, 90% state-owned. It would be wonderful if we could somehow pungle up the money and say, this matters to us. Let's increase the number. Because I found really not very many, a very small percentage of lakes left in northern Wisconsin that are wild. And those that I found were generally smaller, generally very shallow, and often silty, mucky kind of bottoms that were the least desirable to be developed. Now, I happen to love those lakes because they're full of waterfowl, full of songbirds, fabulous plant life, but they're not a place you're going to go water skiing or swimming necessarily. These are often bog or wetland kind of lakes. But anyway, I'd love to see us reinstitute that because, you know, we're not making land anymore and we're certainly not making lakes anymore. So let's protect what we can, all voluntarily, not having the DNR condemn anybody's property. But if someone's a willing seller, let's go for it.
John Bates, the author of Wisconsin's Wildest Lakes, joining us. And John, give me, as a Wisconsin naturalist, I'm curious what it's like for you to enter a lake for the first time. Give me some idea of what it's like to prepare to go into this lake for the first time and how you are trying to document it to share with others.
When you first, pull up to a lake and you're unloading your boat, there's all this excitement and anticipation as a general rule. And what I have to remind myself anyway is to breathe. Just slow down. I've probably driven 55 miles an hour to get to this place, you know, and I'm finally there and I'm just excited. And I have to try to belong. I have to be a part of a place. And the only way I'm a part of a place is if I shut my mouth for one, don't make any further noise. And I need to shut my brain off too. I need to be present. I need to be in the moment. And that sometimes takes a little while, and I didn't always succeed in that, but that's what I would ask everybody to do, you know, or try to do when you come to a wild place like this, is to sit along the shore maybe for a little while, calm yourself, try to just listen, try to be a part of the place, not to be a broadcaster of all of your noise and bang, bang, and, you know, hitting your paddle against your boat, so, you know, all that kind of stuff, but rather be a receiver, be that person who is hearing and seeing everything and going slow along the shoreline. Just go really slow. We're taught as kids to quit poking around. We need to teach ourselves as adults to start poking around. We need to really poke around slow, look at things. That's a skill that very few people have. We tend to want to get from point A to point B and say we did it. Well, the exploration of these wild lakes isn't an endpoint that you're seeking. You're seeking all the things in between and having a relationship to them, having some connection to them, having a deeper appreciation for them. So I think that's what I call for people to do in the introduction, to approach these places with as peaceful and as quiet a mind as they can, and to not be approaching them as a resource opportunity. I want to catch as many fish as I can or shoot as many ducks as I can. People can do that by all means and will do that. But I hope that's a secondary thought. I hope that the first and foremost thought is to love the beauty, just fall in love with these places and be healed by them, frankly. I think the world needs a whole lot of healing these days and needs a lot of inspiration. And these wild places provide both that healing and inspiration.
John, thank you for sharing the beauty with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was WPR's Lee Rayburn talking to naturalist John Bates about his book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, A Guide to the Last Undeveloped Natural Lakes. First, Wisconsin's chief epidemiologist said last week that COVID-19 could go from being a pandemic to endemic by the end of this year. That comes as countries like Spain say they want to shift to an endemic approach, treating the coronavirus like other more common viruses. So what exactly does endemic mean? We're talking now about the future of COVID-19, what it will take to get there, and what the end of the pandemic would mean for our day-to-day lives. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your questions about the future of COVID-19? How about the transition from being a pandemic to an endemic disease? What kind of threshold do you use in your personal life to decide when you're going to take up a safety precaution for COVID or move on from a particular precaution? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Albert Koh is the Raj and Indra Nui Professor of Public Health and a Professor of Epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. Dr. Koh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob. It's a real pleasure to join your show.
Can you start us off with a working definition? What do we mean when we say a disease is endemic?
So endemic means that a disease or an infectious agent has a constant presence and also has a usual prevalence in a population within a geographic area. Now, that said, you can get different levels of transmission or disease burden. For example, some diseases can be hyperendemic, and others could be have much less levels of transmission. And then the other is that you could also have seasonal highs. You could have some endemic diseases that are more common in the winter. Influenza is a good example, which fall off during the warmer summer months.
And there's no switch, right? That today we're in a pandemic, tomorrow we're in an endemic, and everybody agrees on a particular definition. This is going to be a gradual process?
Well, certainly it's not going to be a flip of a switch, and it's going to be a gradual process. And the key issue here is that word usual prevalence, that, you know, where we can expect or we can project how this disease is going to affect us, how COVID specifically is going to affect us, and how the SARS-CoV-2 virus is going to be transmitted. It's really too early for that. You know, we're in a pandemic. This is going to be a gradual trend. Gradual evolution, and it's going to be, you know, we are going to have a situation where, you know, the transmission hasn't evolved or settled for several reasons, and reasons that we can control, into a state which we can predict what's its usual prevalence going to be, not only for this year, but for future years.
You mentioned influenza, and I'd like to look at that as an example. We had just over 100 years ago this global pandemic, very dangerous disease. It didn't end all at once. It became this endemic disease every year. Some people die of flu. Some years we have much worse seasons. Some years we have milder seasons. Is that a picture of a possible future for COVID-19?
Yeah, so there are important differences, certainly between the influenza virus sure. and the COVID virus. The COVID virus is just much more highly transmissible. But you're right, Rob. The influenza, the 1918 Spanish influenza, pandemic, we would have recurrences each year for decades of descendants of that virus that caused disease, in an endemic type of pattern as it slowed out. We had bringing something a little bit more closer to home. We had the H1N1 pandemic in 2009. And we are still seeing circulation of descendants of that virus back in 2009 that are causing seasonal flu epidemics, certainly up to the COVID pandemic. So again, this underscores that this is a gradual process. It's a gradual evolution. And it takes several cycles to understand, where we're going to settle out to get that usual prevalence that we'll know that, these are the number of cases, infections, deaths, and hospitalizations that we'll suffer each year.
Talking to Dr. Albert Koh from the Yale School of Public Health, talking about the future of COVID-19 and the virus that causes it and when and if we would go from our global pandemic to endemic, something that's still there, still dangerous, but is part of our daily lives. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, with your questions about that. That's 800-642-1234. And what leads you to decide now is the time where I'm going to wear masks because of COVID? Now is the time I'm not. What leads you to take more precautions? When do you feel safer doing more stuff? What do you think of the future of that? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jed is with us in Le Coudre. Jed, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Jed?
I just wanted to ask the doctor if the coronavirus, hasn't it always been endemic? Hasn't it been around for a while?
Jed, thanks for the call. Now, as I understand it, Dr. Koh, there are other coronaviruses that may well be endemic. The one that causes COVID-19 for us humans is pretty darn new in the scope of things.
Yeah, that's exactly true. So, Jed, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. We have had coronaviruses for us for centuries, if not longer. The common cold virus is called by a coronavirus. The SARS-CoV-1 virus that caused in 2003, large outbreaks and epidemics in Southeast Asia was also a coronavirus. But this is a very different type of coronavirus, and it's behaving very differently from the common cold coronavirus that, you and I, Rob and Jed, we all get, maybe once every several years. It's much more contagious. It's much more deadlier in terms of causing, hospitalizations and deaths. So, it is a coronavirus. We've lived with these for many thousands of years, but this one is a different one.
Jed, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Koh, one big question about the future of the coronavirus has to do with its mutation rate. How often we get new viruses that behave different, or new variants of the same virus that behave differently. What do we know so far about how quickly this coronavirus can mutate?
Yeah, so this, one thing, so I think there's two issues here. One is how fast it mutates. But then the second bigger question is whether those mutations have an impact, mm-hmm. particularly in our public health impact and on our livelihood. Coronaviruses, it's a type of virus. It's an RNA virus which has frequent mutations in its genome. The DNA that the RNA that makes up its genetic material. The big question is that in what we've seen, certainly, our experience during the pandemic is that certain mutations arise that give it, an increased ability to be more transmissible. Also, its ability to potentially escape immunity, whether that immunity is from a natural infection or from prior vaccination. And those are things that we really worry about. the big kicker in all this is that these are, we really don't have good models that can project when, where, and how these new mutations come up and how they create variants such as Omicron, but also the deadly Delta variant we experienced last summer. So that's a big question mark about the future and this transition from epidemicity or pandemicity to endemicity is whether we're going to be encountering new variants in the future.
We're talking to Dr. Albert Koh, epidemiologist with the Yale School of Public Health. He's with us today to talk about COVID-19, what it would take to transition from the current pandemic stage to an endemic, where it's still there, maybe not the big spikes and huge outbreaks that we see, what it means for our daily lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What would it take for you to get back to normal? Do you already feel like you've gotten back to normal? And do you think even when the pandemic is officially over, are you going to keep masks around for the future and maybe wear them if there's a bad flu season, a bad COVID season in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about the future of the COVID-19 pandemic and what might change when the disease goes from a pandemic to an endemic disease. Dr. Albert Koh is with us from the Yale School of Public Health. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Stephanie is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello. I had like a general question in how maybe the community, at least in like the U.S., is responding to the coronavirus pandemic. I kind of think back on like how in 1918 there was the influenza pandemic and it was a really big thing that happened and people responded in a way. And then I feel like these days, like there's a lot of division and there's a lot of different opinions about it. But it seems like this is very novel for us, like as a, you know, country and also the world to go through this. But then maybe this is novel because 1918, that was a long time ago. So I'm just kind of wondering about like how we can have conversations and talk to people about these kind of things where there's still a lot of division and a lot of different opinions about it.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for the call. I imagine this is still a hot topic for epidemiologists. Albert, what the divisions that have happened when it comes to public health measures related to COVID-19?
Yeah, so that's a subject for a long discussion, but I think the first question, and this is a crucial question that we need to answer, is exactly what the caller asked. We need to understand what we got right and what we got wrong, and we certainly need a national commission to do so, to reflect like we did in our past tragedies. But really, if you look at the scorecard and see how we rate compared to other industrialized countries, we have the highest death rate. Per population, due to COVID, and you know, and so we really do rank low objectively based on just the number of deaths, the number of hospitalizations, the disease burden, and the scale of suffering. So we have to really look into what happened in the past and understand what were those drivers? Why did we get those poor responses? And they're manifold. The caller did mention about our prior experience with influenza. We kind of dodged the bullet back in 2009 with the influenza pandemic, but it wasn't a very contagious or transmissible, and it wasn't a very lethal or virulent virus. And this time we were faced with a challenge which was much greater, which was a virus that's much more severe. And after being infected, and a virus that also is just much more highly transmissible, that really kind of pressure tested our public health system, which has been chronically underfunded in this country. So many reasons, but I think we really need to go through that thoughtful exercise of what worked and what didn't work.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Kathleen in Madison. Kathleen, hi.
Hello. I've been homebound for 2 years because of this COVID, and I have a lot of rather severe health problems related to the disability that I was born with. And I'm also about to turn 69 years old. Am I going to be homebound the rest of my remaining life? Or even when it becomes endemic, how is it safe for someone like me, even if and when it becomes endemic?
Kathleen, thank you so much for sharing your experience and your question. Sorry, this has been a rough couple of years for you, maybe more than most of us. Dr. Koh, what would you say to Kathleen?
Yeah, Kathleen, I take care of a lot of patients, and patients in very similar situations that you've experienced with the isolation, you know, that has gone and really, you know, the suffering in specific segments of our population because of COVID. And I think this reinforces really a basic premise, or, you know, for our society is that we are a community, we are a population. So myself getting vaccinated protects my father, who's 95 years old. Rob getting vaccinated protects you, Kathleen, you know, from getting COVID. And, you know, these go back to kind of the fundamentals of the meat and potato of public health, is that we care about populations. As a physician, I'm concerned about patients, but if I'm concerned about my loved ones, my community, my population, it really takes all of us to do the right thing. In this case, these were, you know, in the days before we had vaccination, there were face masks, social distancing, decreased gathering. Now we have vaccination, it's, you know, and boosters. That's the key lever to pull in order to protect people like you. And that will take your community getting vaccinated in your state, in our country getting vaccinated.
Thanks again for the call, Kathleen. We are talking about the future of COVID-19. Dr. Albert Koh is with us from the Yale School of Public Health. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was just really curious about the doctor's approach to the changing guidance as far as systemic masking, predominantly as it affects school-age children. Obviously, the masking was now found to be quite essential leading into the point of having a vaccination. But now that we do have vaccinations coming out, and it appears to be a reduced efficacy of non-N95 masks towards the Omicron variant, what's your approach towards a more systemic masking policies across schools, public institutions, and such? And how do we move forward through this as we move into an endemic state of the virus?
Tom, thanks for the call. Another huge topic we could spend a whole half hour on, Dr. Koh, but your thoughts on, especially Tom's talking about, I think, masking in our schools.
Yeah, so a couple things. I think we have to remind ourselves there's still 2,600, you know, Americans that are dying each day, you know, from COVID. We are still, you know, COVID in Wisconsin, in my state, Connecticut, is going down. You know, rates are going down. But certainly in many places in the United States, we're still seeing, you know, unacceptable levels of loss of life. And in that type of situation, I think the better part of valor is to do what we can to protect our fellow citizens. And that's certainly vaccination, but we also have to remember that there's always that lag. And, you know, one important group that Tom raised was, you know, children who are just now getting eligible, you know, the less than 5-year-olds are getting eligible for vaccinated. We have low rates of vaccination in our, in our kids from, you know, 5 to 17 years of age. And so, and many of these kids live in multi-generational homes where they're living with elderly people, people perhaps with underlying medical conditions that place them at risk for COVID. And some of these people may not be vaccinated. So, you know, as long as we're on top of this wave, you know, I think the sensible, my personal opinion is the sensible thing is to do what we know works to prevent the transmission. You know, to get out of those unacceptable rates of 2,600 Americans dying a day, do what we know works as vaccination, wearing face masks, certainly indoors, and reducing our gatherings if we can, especially when we're with people who are vulnerable to the severe outcomes of COVID. Now, how long we're going to have to do that really depends on two important questions: how much we can vaccinate the global population. That's not just Wisconsin, it's not the United States, but the world in, as a whole, because we know that COVID, you know, travels, doesn't respect any borders. And then the second is the question raised before, whether we're going to have new variants and that uncertainty. So we're going to have to be prepared in the future.
Thanks for the call, Tom. I want to clarify something you just said. You mentioned moving toward vaccinations for five and under. That's not approved yet. Do I have that right?
I believe the Pfizer vaccine has been approved for emergency use authorization for less than five, years of age.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Time for another caller. Scott is with us in Kewaunee. Scott, hi.
Hello. What
do you want to bring up, Scott?
The doctor. My understanding is this vaccine for COVID is not really a vaccine. It's medication to boost our immune systems. How often or how many times can you boost your immune system before you might do damage to it?
Scott, thanks for the call. Oh, go ahead, Dr. Koh.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rob.
Oh, no. You go ahead and answer Scott's question.
Yeah, Scott, that's an important question. And it's important question for all of us, not only people in the community, but ourselves as scientists and physicians. So what we do know about this vaccine is that people, who have gotten three doses, this has been a safe vaccine. If you've been infected in the past and get two or three doses, it's also safe. And also in Israel, they've been giving a fourth dose, and they found that, that's safe. And there's not a, there isn't any precedent. There is no evidence in prior with prior vaccines where you have what I think you're referring to, Scott, is this what we call immune exhaustion, that you keep on priming the immune response and then you burn it out. That doesn't happen with vaccinations, and that's because you give them at single points in time. And that certainly can happen if you have chronic infections. HIV is a good example. But in this situation of vaccinations, where you're giving them spaced out, that you don't get that immune exhaustion type of phenomenon. So again, I think that reinforces what we know about the vaccine, that they're safe, and that getting these boosters will be an important way to protect people. Now, the question is how many boosters we have to get in the future if we encounter new variants. And that's what, intensive research is being done to really map that out.
Thanks for that call. And Dr. Koh, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob. That was a real pleasure. And thank you for your audience for the really great question.
Yeah, thanks to everybody for your calls. That's Dr. Albert Koh, professor of public health and epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health, with us today to talk about the transition from pandemic to endemic COVID-19, what that could look like, and what it'll take to get there.